Sylvie and Bruno Concluded by Lewis Carroll. Preface. Dreams that elude the maker's frenzied grasp, hands stark and still on a dead mother's breast, which nevermore shall render clasp for clasp, or deftly soothe a weeping child to rest, in such like forms me listeth to portray my tale here ended. Thou delicious fay, the guardian of a sprite that lives to tease thee, loving in earnest, chiding but in play the merry mocking Bruno, who that sees thee can fail to love thee, darling, even as I? My sweetest Sylvie, we must say goodbye. Let me here express my sincere gratitude to the many reviewers who have noticed, whether favorably or unfavorably, the previous volume. Their unfavorable remarks were, most probably, well-deserved, the favorable ones less probably so. Both kinds have no doubt served to make the book known and have helped the reading public to form their opinions of it. Let me also here assure them that it is not from any want of respect for their criticisms that I have carefully forborne from reading any of them. I am strongly of opinion that an author had far better not read any reviews of his books. The unfavorable ones are almost certain to make him cross, and the favorable ones conceited, and neither of these results is desirable. Criticisms have, however, reached me from private sources, to some of which I propose to offer a reply. One such critic complains that Arthur's strictures on sermons and on choristers are too severe. Let me say in reply that I do not hold myself responsible for any of the opinions expressed by the characters in my book. They are simply opinions which, it seemed to me, might probably be held by the persons into whose mouths I put them, and which were worth consideration. Other critics have objected to certain innovations in spelling, such as C-A apostrophe N apostrophe T, W-O apostrophe N apostrophe T, Traveler. In reply, I can only plead my firm conviction that the popular usage is wrong. As to C-A apostrophe N apostrophe T, it will not be disputed that, in all other words ending in N apostrophe T, these letters are an abbreviation of not. And it is surely absurd to suppose that, in this solitary instance, not is represented by apostrophe T. In fact, can't is the proper abbreviation for can it, just as IS apostrophe T is for is it. Again, in WO apostrophe N apostrophe T, the first apostrophe is needed because the word would is here abridged into WO. But I hold it proper to spell D-O-N apostrophe T, don't, with only one apostrophe, because the word do is here complete. As to such words as traveler, I hold the correct principle to be to double the consonant when the accent falls on that syllable, otherwise to leave it single. This rule is observed in most cases, that is, we double the R in preferred, but leave it single in offered, so that I am only extending to other cases an existing rule. I admit, however, that I do not spell parallel as the rule would have it, but here we are constrained by the etymology to insert the double L. In the preface to Volume 1 were two puzzles on which my readers might exercise their ingenuity. One was to detect the two lines of padding, which I had found it necessary to supply in the passage extending from the foot of page 397 of the original text to the middle of page 399. They are the 37th and the 38th lines of page 398. The other puzzle was to determine which, if any, of the 8 stanzas of the Gardener's Song, in the original pages 408, 413, 415, 418, 423, 427, 446, and 448, were adapted to the context, and which, if any, had the context adapted to them. The last of them is the only one that was adapted to the context, the garden door that opened with a key having been substituted for some creature, a cormorant, I think, that, quote, nestled in a tree, close quote. At pages 413, 423, and 446 of the original text, the context was adapted to the stanza. At page 418, neither stanza nor context was altered. The connection between them was simply a piece of good luck. In the preface to Volume 1, at pages 379 and 380 of the original text, I gave an account of the making up of the story of Sylvie and Bruno. A few more details may perhaps be acceptable to my readers. It was in 1873, as I now believe, that the idea first occurred to me that a little fairy tale, written in 1867 for Aunt Judy's magazine under the title Bruno's Revenge, might serve as the nucleus of a longer story. This I surmise from having found the original draft of the last paragraph of Volume 2, dated 1873. So that this paragraph has been waiting 20 years for its chance of emerging into print, more than twice the period so cautiously recommended by Horace for repressing one's literary efforts. It was in February 1885 that I entered into negotiations with Mr. Harry Furness for illustrating the book. Most of the substance of both volumes was then in existence in manuscript, and my original intention was to publish the whole story at once. In September 1885, I received from Mr. Furness the first set of drawings, the four which illustrate Peter and Paul. In November 1886, I received the second set, the three which illustrate the professor's song about the little man who had a little gun. And in January 1887, I received the third set, the four which illustrate the pigtail. So we went on, illustrating first one bit of the story and then another, without any idea of sequence, and it was not until March 1889 that, having calculated the number of pages the story would occupy, I decided on dividing it into two portions and publishing it half at a time. This necessitated the writing of a sort of conclusion for the first volume, and most of my readers, I fancy, regarded this as the actual conclusion when that volume appeared in December 1889. At any rate, among all the letters I received about it, there was only one which expressed any suspicion that it was not a final conclusion. This letter was from a child. She wrote, quote, "We were so glad when we came to the end of the book to find that there was no ending up, for that shows us that you are going to write a sequel," close quote. It may interest some of my readers to know the theory on which this story is constructed. It is an attempt to show what might possibly happen, supposing that fairies really existed, and that they were sometimes visible to us and we to them, and that they were sometimes able to assume human form, and supposing also that human beings might sometimes become conscious of what goes on in the fairy world by actual transference of their immaterial essence, such as we meet with in esoteric Buddhism. I have supposed a human being to be capable of various psychical states with varying degrees of consciousness as follows. A. The ordinary state, with no consciousness of the presence of fairies. B. The eerie state, in which, while conscious of actual surroundings, he is also conscious of the presence of fairies. C. A form of trance in which, while unconscious of actual surroundings and apparently asleep, he, that is, his immaterial essence, migrates to other scenes in the actual world or in fairyland and is conscious of the presence of fairies. I have also supposed a fairy to be capable of migrating from fairyland into the actual world and of assuming, at pleasure, a human form, and also to be capable of various psychical states, that is, A, the ordinary state, with no consciousness of the presence of human beings, B, a sort of eerie state, in which he is conscious, if in the actual world, of the presence of actual human beings, if in fairyland, of the presence of the immaterial essences of human beings. I will here tabulate the passages in both volumes where normal states occur. Editorial note. Please refer to the textual version of this story included on the website to review the table which Lewis Carroll, the author, refers to. In the preface to Volume 1 of the original work, at pages 379 and 380, I gave an account of the origination of some of the ideas embodied in the book. A few more such details may perhaps interest my readers. 1. On page 461, the very peculiar use here made of a dead mouse comes from real life. I found once two very small boys in a garden playing a microscopic game of single wicket. The bat was, I think, about the size of a tablespoon, and the utmost distance attained by the ball in its most daring flights was some 4 or 5 yards. The exact length was, of course, a matter of supreme importance, and it was always carefully measured out, the batsman and the bowler amicably sharing the toil with a dead mouse. On pages 482, the two quasi-mathematical axioms quoted by Arthur at page 482 of Volume 1, that is, things that are greater than the same are greater than one another, and all angles are equal, were actually enunciated in all seriousness by undergraduates at a university situated not 100 miles from Ely. 2. On page 549, Bruno's remark, "I can if I like, etc.," was actually made by a little boy. 2. On page 550, so also was his remark, "I know what it doesn't spell," and his remark, "I just twiddled my eyes, etc., I heard from the lips of a little girl who had just solved a puzzle I had set her." Also in Volume 2, on page 567, in Bruno's soliloquy, "For its father, etc.," was actually spoken by a little girl looking out of the window of a railway carriage. Volume 2, page 597. The remark made by a guest at the dinner party when asking for a dish of fruit, "I've been wishing for them, etc.," I heard made by the great poet laureate, whose loss the whole reading world has so lately had to deplore. In Volume 2, page 506, Bruno's speech on the subject of the age of Mein Herr embodies the reply of a little girl to the question, quote, "Is your grandmother an old lady?" close quote. Quote, "I don't know if she's an old lady," said this cautious young person. "She's 83, close quote. In Volume 2, page 621, the speech about obstruction is no mere creature of my imagination. It is copied verbatim from the columns of the Standard and was spoken by Sir William Harcourt, who was at the time a member of the opposition at the National Liberal Club on July the 16th, 1890. Volume 2, page 669, the professor's remark about a dog's tail, that it doesn't bite at that end, was actually made by a child when warned of the danger he was incurred by pulling the dog's tail. Volume 2, page 685. The dialogue between Sylvie and Bruno, which occupies lines 29 to 34, is a verbatim report, merely substituting cake for penny, of a dialogue overheard between two children. One story in this volume, Bruno's Picnic, I can vouch for as suitable for telling to children, having tested it again and again. And whether my audience has been a dozen little girls in a village school, or some 30 or 40 in a London drawing room, or 100 in a high school, I have always found them earnestly attentive and keenly appreciative of such fun as the story supplied. May I take this opportunity of calling attention to what I flatter myself was a successful piece of name coining at page 400 of the original Volume 1. Does not the name Sibamet fairly embody the character of the sub-warden? The gentle reader has no doubt observed what a singularly useless article in a house a brazen trumpet is if you simply leave it lying about and never blow it. Readers of the first volume who have amused themselves by trying to solve the two puzzles propounded at page 380 of the preface may perhaps like to exercise their ingenuity in discovering which, if any, of the following parallelisms were intentional and which, if any, accidental. Quote, little birds, close quote, events and persons, stanza 1, banquet. 2, chancellor. 3, empress and spinach. Volume 2, page 668. 4. Warden's return. 5. Professor's lecture. Volume 2, page 672. 6. Other professor's song. Volume 1, page 435. 7. Petting of Ugug. 8. Baron Doppelgeist. 9. Jester and Bear. Volume 1, page 429. Little Foxes. 10. Bruno's Dinner Bell. Little Foxes. I will publish the answer to this puzzle in the preface to a little book of original games and puzzles now in course of preparation. I have reserved for the last one or two rather more serious topics. I had intended in this preface to discuss more fully than I had done in the previous volume the morality of sport, with special reference to letters I have received from lovers of sport, in which they point out the many great advantages which men get from it, and try to prove that the suffering which it inflicts on animals is too trivial to be regarded. But when I came to think the subject out, and to arrange the whole of the arguments pro and con, I found it much too large for treatment here. Someday I hope to publish an essay on this subject. At present, I will content myself with stating the net result I have arrived at. It is that God has given to man an absolute right to take the lives of other animals for any reasonable cause, such as the supply of food, but that he hath not given to man the right to inflict pain unless when necessary, that mere pleasure or advantage does not constitute such a necessity, and consequently that pain inflicted for the purposes of sport is cruel and therefore wrong. But I find it a far more complex question than I had supposed, and that the case on the side of the sportsman is a much stronger one than I had supposed. So, for the present, I say no more about it. Objections have been raised to the severe language I have put into the mouth of Arthur at page 489 on the subject of sermons, and at pages 487 and 488 in the original volume on the subjects of choral services and choristers. I have already protested against the assumption that I am ready to endorse the opinions of characters in my story, but in these two instances, I admit that I am much in sympathy with Arthur. In my opinion, far too many sermons are expected from our preachers, and as a consequence, a great many are preached which are not worth listening to, and as a consequence of that, we are very apt not to listen. The reader of this paragraph probably heard a sermon last Sunday morning. Well, let him, if he can, name the text and state how the preacher treated it. Then, as to choristers and all the other accessories of music, vestments, processions, etc., which have come along with them into fashion, while freely admitting that the ritual movement was sorely needed and that it has effected a vast improvement in our church services, which had become dead and dry to the last degree, I hold that, like many other desirable movements, it has gone too far in the opposite direction and has introduced many new dangers. For the congregation, this new movement involves the danger of learning to think that the services are done for them, and that their bodily presence is all they need contribute. And, for clergy and congregation alike, it involves the danger of regarding these elaborate services as ends in themselves, and of forgetting that they are simply means and the very hollowest of mockeries, unless they bear fruit in our lives. For the choristers, it seems to involve the danger of self-conceit, as described at page 488. Nota bene, stagey entrances is a misprint for stage entrances. The danger of regarding those parts of the service where their help is not required as not worth attending to, the danger of coming to regard the service as a mere outward form, a series of postures to be assumed, and of words to be said or sung while the thoughts are elsewhere, and the danger of familiarity breeding contempt for sacred things. Let me illustrate these last two forms of danger from my own experience. Not long ago, I attended a cathedral service and was placed immediately behind a row of men, members of the choir, and I could not help noticing that they treated the lessons as part of the service to which they needed not to give any attention, and as affording them a convenient opportunity for arranging music books, etc., etc. Also, I have frequently seen a row of little choristers, after marching in procession to their places, kneel down as if about to pray, and rise from their knees after a minute spent in looking about them, it being but too evident that the attitude was a mere mockery. Surely it is very dangerous for these children to thus accustom them to pretend to pray. As an instance of irreverent treatment of holy things, I will mention a custom which, no doubt, many of my readers have noticed in churches where the clergy and choir enter in procession. That is, that at the end of the private devotions which are carried on in the vestry, and which are, of course, inaudible to the congregation, the final Amen is shouted loud enough to be heard all through the church. This serves as a signal to the congregation to prepare to rise when the procession appears, and it admits of no dispute that it is for this purpose that it is thus shouted. When we remember to whom that Amen is really addressed, and consider that it is here used for the same purpose as one of the church bells, we must surely admit that it is a piece of gross irreverence. To me, it is as much as if I were to see a Bible used as a footstool. As an instance of the dangers for the clergy themselves introduced by this new movement, let me mention the fact that, according to my experience, clergymen of this school are especially apt to retail comic anecdotes in which the most sacred names and words, sometimes actual text from the Bible, are used as themes for jesting. Many such things are repeated as having been originally said by children whose utter ignorance of evil must no doubt acquit them in the sight of God of all blame. but it must be otherwise for those who consciously use such innocent utterances as material for their unholy mirth. Let me add, however, most earnestly, that I fully believe that this profanity is, in many cases, unconscious. The environment, as I have tried to explain at pages 590 and 591, makes all the difference between man and man, and I rejoice to think that many of these profane stories, which I find so painful to listen to and should feel it a sin to repeat, give to their ears no pain and to their consciences no shock, and that they can utter, not less sincerely than myself, the two prayers, Hallowed be thy name, and From hardness of heart and contempt of thy word and commandment, good Lord, deliver us, to which I would desire to add for their sake and for my own, Keble's beautiful petition, Help us this and every day to live more nearly as we pray. It is, in fact, for its consequences, for the grave dangers both to speaker and to hearer, which it involves, rather than for what it is in itself, that I mourn over this clerical habit of profanity in social talk. To the believing hearer, it brings the danger of loss of reverence for holy things by the mere act of listening to and enjoying such jests, and also the temptation to retail them for the amusement of others. To the unbelieving hearer, it brings a welcome confirmation of his theory that religion is a fable, in the spectacle of its accredited champions thus betraying their trust. And to the speaker himself, it must surely bring the danger of loss of faith, for surely such jests, if uttered with no consciousness of harm, must necessarily be also uttered with no consciousness at the moment of the reality of God as a living being who hears all we say. And he who allows himself the habit of thus uttering holy words with no thought of their meaning is but too likely to find that for him God has become a myth and heaven a poetic fancy, that for him the light of life is gone, and that he is at heart an atheist lost in a darkness that may be felt. There is, I fear, at the present time, an increasing tendency to irreverent treatment of the name of God and of subjects connected with religion. Some of our theaters are helping this downward movement by the gross caricatures of clergymen which they put upon the stage. Some of our clergy are themselves helping it by showing that they can lay aside the spirit of reverence along with their surplices and can treat as jests, when outside their churches, names and things to which they pay an almost superstitious veneration when inside. The Salvation Army has, I fear, with the best intentions, done much to help it by the coarse familiarity with which they treat holy things, and surely every one who desires to live in the spirit of the prayer, Hallowed be thy name, ought to do what he can, however little that may be, to check it. So I have gladly taken this unique opportunity, however unfit the topic may seem for the preface to a book of this kind, to express some thoughts which have weighed on my mind for a long time. I did not expect, when I wrote the preface to Volume 1, that it would be read to any appreciable extent. But I rejoice to believe, from evidence that has reached me, that it has been read by many, and to hope that this preface will also be so. And I think that among them some will be found ready to sympathize with the views I have put forwards, and ready to help, with their prayers and their example, the revival, in society, of the waning spirit of reverence. Lewis Carroll, Christmas, 1893. The End of the Preface. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit to Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.